The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
That verse begins, because just as through one man sin came into the world, and through sin death, and thus upon all men death spread, because all sinned. F. Ho Pontes Hamerton. I think the heart of Murray's study, the most crucial thing in it, is his careful refutation of the popular Pelagian interpretation of that expression, because all sinned. What is that Pelagian interpretation of that phrase? Which is important, you see, not because Pelagius put it forward, dead and gone, but because so many understand this verse this way who've never heard of Pelagius. What is that very popular understanding, Steve?
It's just reaffirming that all people sin, and so they die. They sin just like Adam sinned.
Right. Just as Adam sinned, he died. All men sin personally, and they die. Looks pretty straightforward, right? Indeed, I suspect that that's the view most commonly held by Christians nowadays. I've never taken a poll, but I suspect that it is. And if it's not the most popular interpretation nowadays, then perhaps the view that is, these might vie for most popular, would be the idea that Paul there in that phrase is referring to the race's involvement in the depravity as a result of Adam's sin. That what Paul means when he says, because all sinned, is that inherited depravity that all men now have as a result of Adam's sin. And that was the interpretation of John Calvin. And so it's important for us that Murray addresses that interpretation also when he refutes Calvin's interpretation. So let's look at those two interpretations just very briefly now in terms of Murray's objections to them. I'm not going to try to go back on my word of saying I've assigned you the book and we won't do everything in class, but there are some things that I think are important enough that I ought to hit some key points.
How would you translate it?
Because all sinned. Now, Murray notes, first of all, that the construction of verse 12, and of that last phrase, because all sinned, does not, I accent this because on the final exam, and I'm almost willing to make a little wager with you, that some of you will tell me one of the things against the Pelagian interpretation is the grammatical construction. And I'll write in the margin, no, not so. But anyway, I'll say it here. That construction does not disprove the Pelagian interpretation. The fact that the verb is aorist. Murray points out that Romans 3:23, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, says the same thing that the Pelagian wants to say about this. There's an aorist tense there, all sinned, and yet it refers evidently to the sins of individuals down through history. If that's what it means in Romans 3:23, grammatically it could mean that here. So the aorist doesn't rule out the Pelagian interpretation. But Murray emphasizes that there are, however, conclusive objections, conclusive as he sees it, not just probable, but conclusive objections on factual, exegetical, and theological grounds. Objections to the Pelagian understanding on factual, exegetical, and theological grounds. And there are four objections in particular that Murray brings against the Pelagian view. And here's where I say they're so important that I would like to summarize them for you by pulling out the key sentences from this book on pages 10, 11, and 12. Okay, we're looking at what Murray says on pages 10, 11, and 12. Four objections to the Pelagian understanding, which I hope you're understanding, of this phrase. I said it was very popular. Let me just say that even such a sound Reformed commentator as William Hendrickson understands Romans 5:12b in this way, which we're calling the Pelagian way. In his commentary on Romans, volume 1, pages 178 to 179. Okay, here are the four objections. Number one, you may even want to memorize these objections. Of course, you want to flesh them out by reading the whole section. I'm just going to give you the key sentence. Number one, not all die because, as a matter of fact, they actually involuntarily sin. Infants die. Would the Pelagian want to suggest that infants die because of their own personal voluntary sin? That's what he means by a factual objection. It just isn't true that all persons die because they have themselves actually personally voluntarily sinned. Infants die, and they haven't done those things. Second objection. If you look at verses 13 and 14 here that follow immediately this verse 12, Paul states the opposite of the Pelagian view. He emphasizes in verses 13 and 14 that death reigns universally and therefore reigns over those who are in a different category from that of Adam. He says that sin was indeed in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law, yet death reigned from Adam to Moses before the law was given, even over those whose sins were not like, emphasis on the not like, the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. So verses 13 and 14 seem to stress the opposite from the Pelagian insistence that everybody has imitated Adam and have transgressed voluntarily a known law. But, Mr. Murray says, thirdly, that the most conclusive refutation of the Pelagian interpretation is derived from the repeated and emphatic affirmation of Paul in the immediate context here, affirmations to the effect that the universal sway of condemnation and death is to be referred not to the many sins of the many men, but to the one sin of the one man, Adam. On at least five occasions, five different times, in verses 15 to 19, that principle is asserted. If Paul wanted to be teaching the Pelagian view here, he has a strange way of doing it, you might say. Instead of stressing the many sins of the many men leading to condemnation and death, he keeps saying again and again that it's the one sin of the one man that has led for everyone to condemnation and death. Murray writes, it's quite impossible to construe this emphasis upon the one sin of the one man as equivalent to the actual personal sin of countless individuals. And then fourth objection, the Pelagian exegesis of Romans 5:12b, occasionally it's convenient to be able to say B. I've told you before, don't get up in the pulpit and say our text for this morning is Romans 5:12b. Everybody's scurrying looking for B. But I can say it to you because we're professionals, right? The Pelagian exegesis destroys the force of the analogy that Paul institutes in this passage as a whole. Paul is establishing the truth that men are justified and attain to life by what another has done, namely the one man, Jesus Christ. Let me interrupt Murray's statement there just to kind of accent that. Always remember that this section that does deal with sin, with Adam, with condemnation, with death, comes into the book of Romans. Why? For what purpose? Not so that the apostle can hit sinners over the head with this truth and just tell them how bad they really are for that purpose, you know, all by itself, let's say. No, he brings this in as part, and I would say a key part, of his argument for the good news of grace in Christ. He's trying to get us to understand more clearly the truth of justification by comparing it with what has happened because of Adam's sin. Now, what happens because of Christ's obedience? It's a positive, if you want to use that word, gracious reason that this whole argument comes into play. But as Murray says, Paul is establishing the truth that men are justified and attain to life by what another has done. Not by what they've done, by what the one man Jesus Christ has done. Going on with Murray, quote, Paul's doctrine of justification would be nullified if at this point the parallel he uses to illustrate and confirm the doctrine of justification is after the pattern of the Pelagian construction. Now, I hope that's clear all by itself, but to make sure it is, would somebody just tell us what that just said? What's Murray's point there? Would somebody sum it up for us, Gary? Right, that's it, exactly. Right, if the analogy is analogous, that would be what you would then have to teach. Now, of course, Pelagianism said, fine, that's what we do teach. But the point is, that's not what Paul taught. Okay, if you're a Pelagian, that doesn't hit you because you say, sure, just as condemnation and death flow from the personal sins of persons, so justification and life flow from the personal obedience of persons. But the problem is that's not what Paul taught. And as Gary says, Paul's teaching in this whole section in the book of Romans is to the effect that we are justified by faith in Christ alone, not on the basis of any good works of our doing or any obedience on our part, but on the basis of his obedience. Adopt the Pelagian interpretation of Romans 12b, and Murray insists, you have destroyed the argument. You have destroyed the point of the analogy. Now, next in these pages still, 10 to 12, Murray goes on next to refute the Roman Catholic interpretation of this passage, which is that the sin of Adam, which is the sin of all, according to Romans 5:12b, is that which by propagation is transfused into all. In other words, depravity, original sin. Whatever label you want to use. Now, what Murray presents by way of objections to that understanding apply, you see, also to Calvin's understanding. Because although Calvin's doctrine of original sin, of depravity, Murray says is radically different from that of Rome, still Calvin's exegesis of that key clause, Epho Pontes Hamartan, in verse 12, Calvin's exegesis of that clause is the same as that of Rome. Murray wants us to not forget that Roman Catholicism taught that original sin consisted simply in the lack of original righteousness and integrity, and that the concupiscence which resulted from the loss of integrity was not itself truly and properly sinful, that warfare between flesh and soul was only sinful when it led to sinful results, whereas, quoting Murray, according to Calvin, the original sin which is conveyed by natural generation is itself intrinsically radical depravity, really sinful. But while those two different understandings of depravity must be recognized, not underestimated, still Calvin, like Rome, understood Paul in Romans 5:12b to be referring to that depravity conveyed to Adam's posterity rather than being a reference to the imputation to Adam's posterity of Adam's first sin. That sin itself. And I'm wondering, is that clear to everybody? My suspicion is that there are many Christians who, when they think about the sin of Adam and our relation to it, think exclusively in terms of that depraved nature, that sinful nature, which is now native to all of Adam's posterity. And there's no question, and we'll come to this when we get to that point in the outline, no question that the Scripture teaches that the heart of man is now depraved. He needs a new heart, which is the biblical way of speaking of that new orientation, okay, to good and to God. However, that's not our only involvement with Adam. And as a matter of fact, what Murray's arguing in your book is that that's not what Romans 5:12b is referring to. What is referring to is not that depravity conveyed, as the Westminster Confession puts it, to all who are born by natural generation, but is referring to that sin of Adam. That very transgression, that very first sin, imputed to the account, let me put it that way, of every one of Adam's sons and daughters in the creation covenant. So that while Murray certainly wants to say that Calvin's doctrine of depravity is a biblical one, what he's saying here is, it's not the one the Bible's teaching in this passage, however. It's not enough to be teaching biblical truth. If you're saying that biblical truth is taught in whatever passage you're looking at, it's important that it really be taught there. Okay? You get the point, and the point of the difference. Now, I hope that helps. I'm not sure it's entirely clear, but let me go on, and then we'll find out maybe later if it has been clear. Murray's objections to the interpretation of Romans 5:12b that says it's a reference to that inherited depravity are the objections that he presents on pages 15 to 17 against the Roman Catholic view. Don't miss the point that since Calvin's exegesis is the same, they are also his objections against Calvin's view. Okay? If you should just possibly be asked on the exam, since the class has been asked this for the last 27 years or whatever, if you should just possibly be asked not only to give Murray's objections to the Pelagian view, but also to Calvin's interpretation, you have to make use, you see, of his arguments against the Roman Catholic exegesis. So don't miss where they are. And those objections are threefold. And let me give them to you. I was going to say before the break, but I ought to do one more thing also before the break. But here are those objections. Number one, and I'm using Murray's own words here, just pulling out the key sentences at each point. Number one, it would be exceedingly difficult to adjust the notion in question to the thought expressed by the aorist hamartan. His point is, if you understand all sinned, there at the end of verse 12, as a reference to this, he doesn't think that would be well expressed by that aorist verb. We're not talking about sinful action, word, deed. We're talking now, according to Calvin, about depravity of nature. Murray says that doesn't seem to be well expressed by the aorist hamartan. In other words, his appeal to the aorist comes against Calvin, not against the Pelagians. But notice that he characterizes that first argument as, quote, presumptive rather than conclusive. He doesn't think that is so weighty that it would settle the matter all by itself. He thinks there's some weight to it, but he doesn't feel it's immediately conclusive. So we have to go on to the second argument, quote, more cogent is the theological consideration that this view does not accord with the parallel or analogy which Paul institutes in this passage. Aha, we're back to that analogy again that I put on the transparency that way. The doctrine of Paul is that we are justified on the basis of the righteousness of Christ and not by a righteousness infused into us any more than by a righteousness wrought by us. Now, I hope that's clear. Against the Pelagian notion, Murray had argued that the Pelagian notion is that one is justified on the basis of his own acts of obedience. That clearly causes Paul's analogy to break down, because that's not his doctrine of justification. But against Calvin's interpretation, or the Roman Catholic interpretation, Murray argues that neither is it Paul's doctrine of justification, that we're justified on the basis of that new nature infused in us through the Spirit's work of sanctification in our lives. Now that, of course, was not Calvin's doctrine of justification, so if Calvin were alive to read Murray's argument, I suspect he would have been convinced by it and would have changed his exegesis. He didn't have the advantage of living this side of Murray's book. But while that's not Calvin's doctrine of justification, it is, of course, the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification, as we got into that in the Holy Spirit course in the first semester, which speaks of justification as progressive and confuses justification with sanctification and sees us being justified on the basis of that righteousness infused into us, inwrought in us through sanctification. But, Murray says, that's not Paul's doctrine of justification. Paul's doctrine of justification is that we are justified on the basis of the righteousness of Christ, not inwrought in us, that's sanctification, you mustn't confuse that with justification, that righteousness of Christ imputed to our account, imputed to us by God's grace. And if the analogy then is really analogous, that calls for our seeing this to be in view in Romans 5:12b, not the matter of depravity. Is that clear? Is there anybody to whom that isn't crystal clear? How could we make it crystal clear? Okay, again, remember what he's refuting about Calvin is his exegesis. And I keep using, I hate that phrase, awkward phrase, Romans 5:12b, but it's just my easy label, so I don't have to give the whole phrase again. He's refuting Calvin's exegesis of that phrase, and therefore of what Paul's talking about here. He's not arguing with Calvin's theology. Okay? But we want to understand every chapter of the Bible, including Romans 5. Yes. Not only Romans 3 and 4. Which Calvin does get straight, but also Romans 5:12 and following.
Is Calvin talking anywhere else of the imputation of Adam's sin to all others?
Yeah, good question.
And do other church fathers or figures prior to Murray?
Oh, yes, definitely yes
ancient,
on that.
I meant to say ancient.
Yeah, well, he calls this the classic Protestant. Okay. Yeah, that you'd probably be hard-pressed to find. Yeah, he calls it the classic Protestant interpretation. Yeah, that's a good point. I ought to look up and find those passages because I feel pretty sure I could find them in Calvin. But he doesn't understand this phrase in those terms.
If you don't get from that exact phrase, it seems you have to get it from Romans 5.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15, maybe. Yes, Scott.
When Packer was lecturing on this, he said that...
Not the Roman Catholics, as far as I'm aware, at... the time. Now, I could put a little different turn on that, I guess, by saying that just in the same way that Calvin begins Book 3 of the Institutes by speaking of sanctification and leaves justification for later, in order to make the point we are slandered when it is said that we don't believe in sanctification. I will take it up first to show how important we consider it to be. That's a little turn, if I understood what you said. It might be that you could argue along that line that Calvin was so intent on making it clear that he believed in this aspect of the truth as well as the justification aspect you could, you know, maybe speculate that that was going on here.
I wouldn't try to say that it equals classic split justification. Supposedly, Packer was saying
that. No, you were saying this. Not this, but this. Yeah. Now, that was only the second, right? We haven't given the third one yet. I said we would do it before the break. Having said it, I'm going to press ahead. Point three, most conclusive, Murray starts this sentence by saying, most conclusive is the objection that the interpretation being debated here, he calls it Roman Catholic and Calvin, is inconsistent with the sustained emphasis upon the oneness of the sin and of the man. Original sin is the sin that belongs to all who come by natural generation into the world and cannot be regarded as conforming to such a specification as the one sin of the one man, Adam. The one sin of the one man, Adam, that's what you're talking about when you talk about the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity. Depravity cannot readily be spoken of as the one sin of the one man. Yeah, I think he has reversed the order. The third point, right. And then the fourth point is very much along the lines as the second point now in the objections against Calvin. Okay, because he's reversed the order, if you will. One more point to make before the break, and that is to simply say what I guess we've implied all along. And that is that Adam's a party to this covenant, not simply as an individual. First of all, we see that when we see that the penalty pronounced has fallen upon the whole race. And then secondly, that very fact comes in when we see the analogy drawn between Adam and Christ. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 45 to 49, certainly present that same analogy to us. And a proper understanding of that analogy is so important to a proper understanding of the whole doctrine of the covenants. And surely in view of that analogy, we're forced to see, are we not, in the relationship between Adam and those in him, a union, a solidarity, analogous to the union between Christ and those in him. Probably you didn't need a lot of convincing that Adam was a party to this covenant, not just for himself, but for his posterity. But where you might need a little more help is now as we move after we'll take five to the second point. What's the nature of that union? Okay, Adam's in union with those who come after him, but how? What's the nature of that relationship? And we'll look at that.
Is that where we'll discuss the nature of man's guilt of Adam's sin?
All set. Let me just say, when I come back from break with a cup of coffee, I sometimes remember the old school teacher saying, you know, you can't have chewing gum unless you've brought enough for everybody, and I haven't brought enough for everybody. I would just urge you to get your own coffee if, like me, by this time of the afternoon, I'm not a coffee drinker, certainly not a coffee addict, but I need some help to keep really being sharp. So, don't hesitate to bring it back from the break time. Gary?
Are we going to spend more time on this analogy?
Not at this point.
Because I think...
We're going to get into it as soon as we get into the representative view. So, maybe.
Not everyone's clicking. And what may be informative is to bring in, on the basis of this analogy, where depravity and sanctification...
Okay, well, in terms of the analogy is being brought into the picture here, Romans 5, in the argument on justification. Okay, so in terms, right, in that sense, sanctification isn't coming into the picture. But if you want to bring it in, then you say that in the same way that I had it up here before I erased it, that depraved nature is ours because of our covenant relationship to the first Adam. So a regenerated nature now is ours by sanctification. by virtue of our union with the second Adam in that covenant. So that there is that, you see, comparison, if you will, between sanctification and that depravity, just as there is between justification and the imputation of the sin of Adam. I'm always struggling, as I'm sure you're aware, between a certain tension between knowing that we've got a semester course before us to complete and wanting everything to be clear. I myself have the feeling that I do my best teaching when I'm writing on the board or waving my hands or something, and I'd like to just do that the whole time, but then we probably wouldn't get any farther than we are. So we'll go back to the more formal approach of the outline, but hope to get carried away from it occasionally along the way. But now we're asking the question about the nature of that union, that relationship between Adam and his posterity. And here, as far as your reading is concerned, this is chapter 2, I would notice, in John Murray's The Imputation of Adam's Sin. Now, first of all, we're calling this small a biological union, or seminal, or genealogical, different terms could be used. First of all Bible believers would grant that Adam is the first father of all mankind. And many have said that this kind of union is all that was necessary for Adam's posterity to be bound up with him in his act of sin and the resulting condemnation and death, to have that imputed to them because they are his sons, if you will. And appeal is made to the text in Hebrews 7, verses 9 and 10, where you may recall the argument for the superiority of the priesthood of Melchizedek goes like this, that Levi was in the loins of Abraham, in the body of Abraham, when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, and so it can be said Levi paid tithes to Melchizedek. Levi, the father of the Levitical priesthood, paid tithes to Melchizedek, showing the superiority of the priesthood of Melchizedek, even though Levi wasn't born at the time that those tithes were paid, you see. The argument of the writer is that Levi was, in the expression, in the loins of Abraham, in the body of Abraham. Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, so Levi paid tithes to Melchizedek. Could it not therefore be argued that all mankind was in the loins of Adam when he sinned, and on that basis they sinned with him and they fell with him in his first transgression? Early Reformed theology stressed this, and the Westminster Confession doesn't stress anything else. In the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 6, paragraph 3, you read this. They, Adam and Eve, being the root of all mankind, notice, being the biological root of all mankind, the guilt of this sin was imputed, and the same death in sin and corrupted nature conveyed to all their posterity descending from them by ordinary generation. At the time the Westminster Confession was written, the framers thought this matter of biological, genealogical union was all that needed to be affirmed. Now, when you get to the larger catechism of Westminster and question 22, the statement there is a little different. Now, covenantal reality is emphasized. Let me read it. The covenant being made with Adam as a public person, not for himself only, but for his posterity, all mankind descending from him by ordinary generation, sinned in him and fell with him in that first transgression. Now, some people have said, why the difference between Westminster Confession, where the only thing mentioned is biological union, and Westminster Larger Catechism, where now we hear about a covenant and Adam is a public person? Seems to be the idea of representative. Murray notes the difference between them in a footnote on page 38 of your reading assignment, but he offers no explanation for the difference there. But in his course that he used to give on the Westminster Confession of Faith, he used to suggest that the explanation might well lie in the fact that Joshua Placaeus, with his doctrine of mediate imputation, And if that doesn't immediately ring a bell, I'm just going to leave it there at this point. You'll get into that as you read the book. But Joshua Placaus and his doctrine of mediate imputation was condemned at the 28th Synod of the Reformed Churches in France in January of 1645. That is, between the time that the Westminster Confession and the Larger Catechism were written. And Murray's suggestion is that that very debate in France highlighted the need for greater precision in formulating the doctrine of the relationship between Adam and his posterity. And so when they came to write the Larger Catechism, they went beyond biological union. Well, it's an interesting suggestion. Be that as it may, however, in the development of theology generally, it's been recognized that mere seminal or biological union, all by itself, is not enough to explain the involvement of the whole human race in the one trespass of Adam. And the major reason why theologians have looked for some additional kind of union is that if biological union is all that you have, how do you explain that we are not held accountable for all the sins that Adam committed in all his lifetime? Why just this first sin, if the only reality is biological or genealogical union? We were still in his loins, so to speak, throughout his life. Is something additional at work here? Now, John Murray says on page 24 that there are only two views of what I'm calling this necessary additional relationship that are really worthy of consideration: realism and representation. Covenantal, however you want to call that second one. In the light of its contemporary popularity, and especially G.C. Birkhauer's enthusiasm for it, in Birkhauer's book with the title Sin, we might want to add some comments on the concept of corporate personality, and so I put that on the outline. Corporate personality, that idea suggested by the Baptist theologian, British H. Wheeler Robinson. So let's look at those. First of all, at what is called realistic union. All these views are certainly recognizing biological union, but they're saying, but there's something else, more, also. And on the outline now, I'm going to put in a one in brackets, and we'll call this statement of the view. Okay, we're on small b, realistic union, one in brackets, statement of the view. When we talk about realism, we're talking here about the view in theology, particularly associated in American Reformed theology with William G.T. Shedd of Union Seminary, back when Union Seminary had some teachers worth reading, listening to, and the Baptist theologian Augustus Hopkins Strong. Shedd and Strong in America. And since then, especially in the South, there has been some popularity of this. Birkhauer deals especially with the Dutch theologian S. Gradanus, who enthusiastically endorsed Shedd's realism in 1906, and who was followed in turn in the Netherlands by Klaus Schilder. Even though, according to Birkhauer, Gradanus did not follow Shedd's philosophical explanation, and proposed a rather naive and finally an unintelligible realism. So Birkhauer at least says that Gradanus's realism was naive and really not intelligible, but still it was a realism. Anthony Hookham claims to be sympathetic toward realism. But although I know this is going to sound, I don't know what, a little presumptuous or something, I don't think Hookham understands realism when he says he favors it. And I'll have to explain that when we get down just a little bit farther. What he says he favors, I think, is simply biological union. But he calls it realism. According to realism, now, we're stating the view. According to realism, And I warn you now, you have to put yourself in philosophy mode, okay? You're all going to screw on the philosophical caps here. And I'm not a philosopher. This is going to be a hard way of thinking, but try it with me. According to realism, there is such a thing as human nature, which is a specific and numerical unity. Shedd calls this human nature an elementary invisible substance. And it's a real thing, if you will, an elementary invisible substance. Pardon? It's not around right now, of course. Okay. This human nature existed in its entirety in Adam. Existed in its entirety in Adam, and this human nature is then individualized in each member of the human race. This human nature existing in its entirety in Adam and Eve sinned when Adam sinned. And you see, since every person coming into the world is an individualization of the one human nature, each person, as an individual portion of that human nature, is both guilty, culpable, and punishable for the sin committed by this one human nature. Talk about being chips off the old block. Here it is with a vengeance, okay? That whole block of human nature existed in its entirety in Adam. And then Shedd will usually say in a parenthesis, and Eve. Which makes it a little more difficult, but anyway. It existed in its entirety there. And now with the birth of every individual, we are all individualizations, chips off that block, so to speak. Since that block, that human nature, sinned when Adam sinned, and we're individualizations of it, we are guilty and punishable for that sin. I don't know how better to get you into realism than to give it to you the way Shedd presents it. So let me, for just a little while, share with you from Shedd in Volume 2 of his Dogmatic Theology. And I'm quoting. In discussing either traducianism or creationism, it is important to define the idea of substance. The term in this connection does not imply either extension or figure. Okay, chips off the old block. Not very good statement, I guess. Because this term does not imply either extension or figure, it's taken in its etymological and metaphysical sense to denote that entity which stands under phenomena and is the base for them. Substance, okay? Etymologically, literally, stands under, substance. As in theology, the divine substance, or nature, is unextended and formless, yet a real entity, so in anthropology, the human substance, or nature, is without extension or figure, yet it is a certain amount of real being. Notice the quantitative language. A certain amount of real being with definite and distinguishable properties. That was on page 12. Let me go way over now to page 71. There is a spurious realism, a false realism, arising from a wrong definition of the term human nature. Human nature is sometimes explained to be merely a common property of a substance, like rationality or immortality. As all individual men have rationality and immortality as a characteristic quality, so all men have humanity or human nature as a characteristic quality.